F is for Fugitive by Sue Grafton. Copyright 1989 by Sue Grafton. This recording of the full-length reading of F is for Fugitive was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Incorporated and was produced in 1994 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. This book is read by Mary Pfeiffer. Chapter 1. The Ocean Street Motel in Floral Beach, California, is located, oddly enough, on Ocean Street, a stone's throw from the sea wall that slants 10 feet down toward the Pacific. The beach is a wide band of beige, trampled with footprints that are smoothed away by the high tide every day. Public access is afforded by a set of concrete stairs with a metal rail. A wooden fishing pier, built out into the water, is anchored at the near end by the office of the Port Harbor Authority, which is painted a virulent blue. 17 years ago, Jean Timberlake's body had been found at the foot of the sea wall, but the spot wasn't visible from where I stood. At the time, Bailey Fowler, an ex-boyfriend of hers, pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter. Now he'd changed his tune. Every violent death represents the climax of one story and an introduction to its sequel. My job was to figure out how to write the proper ending to the tale. Not easy after so much time had elapsed. Floral Beach has a population so modest the number isn't even posted on a sign anywhere. The town is 6 streets long and 3 streets deep, all bunched up against a steep hill largely covered with weeds. There may be as many as 10 businesses along Ocean, 3 restaurants, a gift shop, a pool hall, a grocery store, a t-shirt shop that rents boogie boards, a frosty freeze, and an art gallery. Around the corner on Palm, there's a pizza parlor and a laundromat. Everything closes down after 5 o'clock, except the restaurants. Most of the cottages are one-story board and batten, painted pale green or white, built in the 30s by the look of them. The lots are small and fenced, many with power boats moored in the side yards. Sometimes the boats are in better condition than the properties on which they sit. There are several boxy stucco apartment buildings with names like the Sea View, the Tides, and the Surf and Sand. The whole town resembles the backside of some other town, but it has a vaguely familiar feel to it, like a shabby resort where you might have spent a summer as a kid. The motel itself is 3 stories high, painted lime green with a length of sidewalk in front that peters out into patchy grass. I'd been given a room on the second floor with a balcony that allowed me to look left as far as the oil refinery, surrounded by chain-link fence and posted with warning signs, and to my right as far as Port Harbor Road, a quarter of a mile away. A big resort hotel with a golf course is tucked up along the hill, but the kind of people who stay there would never come down here, despite the cheaper rates. It was late afternoon, and the February sun was setting so rapidly it appeared to be defying the laws of nature. The surf thundered dully, waves washing toward the sea wall like successive buckets of soapy water being sloshed up on the sand. The wind was picking up, but it made no sound, probably because Floral Beach has so few trees. The seagulls had assembled for supper, settling on the curb to peck at foodstuffs spilling out of the trash cans. Since it was a Tuesday, there weren't many tourists, and the few hardy souls who had walked the beach earlier had fled when the temperature began to drop. I left the sliding glass door ajar and went back to the table where I was typing up a preliminary report. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator, licensed by the state of California, operating ordinarily in the town of Santa Teresa, 95 miles north of Los Angeles. Floral Beach is another hour and a half farther up the coast. I'm 32 years old, twice married, no kids, currently unattached and likely to remain so given my disposition, which is cautious at best. At the moment, I didn't even have a legitimate address. I'd been living with my landlord, Henry Pitts, while my garage apartment was being rebuilt. My stay at the Ocean Street Motel was being underwritten by Bailey Fowler's father, who had hired me the day before. I had just moved back into my office, newly refurbished by California Fidelity, the insurance company that accords me space in exchange for my services. The walls had been painted a fresh white. The carpeting was slate blue, a short pile wool shag that cost $25 a yard, exclusive of padding and installation, folks. I know this because I peeked at the invoice the day the carpet was laid. My file cabinet was in place, my desk arranged near the French doors as usual, a new Sparklets water cooler plugged in and ready to provide both hot and cold trickling water, depending on which button I pushed. This was classy stuff, and I was feeling pretty good, almost recovered from the injuries I'd sustained on the last case I worked. Since I'm self-employed, I pay my disability insurance before I even pay my rent. My first impression of Royce Fowler was of a once robust man whose aging processes had accelerated suddenly. I guessed him to be in his 70s, somewhat shrunken from an impressive 6'4". It was clear from the way his clothing hung that he'd recently dropped maybe 30 pounds. He looked like a farmer, a cowboy, or a roustabout, someone accustomed to grappling with the elements. His white hair was thinning, combed straight back, with ginger strands still visible along his ears. His eyes were ice blue, brows and lashes sparse, his pale skin mottled with broken capillaries. He used a cane, but the big hands he kept folded together on the crook of it were as steady as stone and speckled with liver spots. He'd been helped into the chair by a woman I thought might be a nurse or a paid companion. He didn't see well enough to drive himself around. "I'm Royce Fowler," he said. His voice was gravelly and strong. "This is my daughter, Anne. My wife would have driven down with us, but she's a sick woman, and I told her to stay at home. We live in Floral Beach." I introduced myself and shook hands with them both. There was no family resemblance that I could see. His facial features were oversized, big nose, high cheekbones, strong chin, while hers were apologetic. She had dark hair and a slight overbite that should have been corrected when she was a kid. The quick mental flash I had of Floral Beach was of summer cottages gone to seed and wide, empty streets lined with pickup trucks. "You drove down for the day?" "I had an appointment at the clinic," he rumbled. "What I got they can't treat, but they take my money anyway. I thought we should talk to you as long as we're in town." His daughter stirred but said nothing. I pegged her at 40-some and wondered if she still lived at home. So far, she'd avoided making eye contact with me. I don't do well at small talk, so I shifted down a gear into business mode. "What can I do for you, Mr. Fowler?" His smile was bitter. "I take it the name doesn't mean much to you." "Rings a dim bell," I said. "Can you fill me in?" "My son, Bailey, was arrested in Downey 3 weeks ago by mistake. They figured out pretty quick they had the wrong man, so they released him within a day. Then I guess they turned around and ran a check on him, and his prints came up a match. He was rearrested night before last." I nearly said, "A match with what?" But then my memory gave a lurch. I'd seen an article in the local paper. "Ah, yes," I said. "He escaped from San Luis 16 years ago, didn't he?" "That's right. I never heard from him after the escape, and finally decided he was dead. The boy nearly broke my heart, and I guess he's not done yet." The California Men's Colony near San Luis Obispo is a two-part institution, a minimum security unit for old men and a medium security facility divided into 4 600-man sections. Bailey Fowler had apparently walked away from a work detail and hopped on the freight train that rumbled past the prison twice a day back then. "How'd he get tripped up?" "There was a warrant out on a fellow named Peter Lambert, the name he was using. He says he was booked, fingerprinted, and in the can before they realized they had the wrong man. As I understand it, some hot shoe detective got a bug up his butt and ran Bailey's prints through some fancy-pants new computer system they got down there. That's how they picked up on the fugitive warrant. By a damn fluke." "Bum deal for him," I said. "What's he going to do?" "I hired him a lawyer. Now he's back, I want him cleared." "You're appealing the conviction?" Anne seemed on the verge of a response, but the old man plowed right over her. "Bailey never went to trial. He made a deal, pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter on the advice of this court-appointed PD, the worthless son of a bitch." "Really?" I said, wondering why Mr. Fowler hadn't hired a lawyer for him at the time. I also wondered what kind of evidence the prosecution had. Usually the DA won't make a deal unless he knows his case is weak. "What's the new attorney telling you so far?" He won't commit himself until he sees the files, but I want to make sure he has all the help he can get. There's no such thing as a private detective up in Floral Beach, which is why we came to you. We need someone to go to work, dig in and see if there's anything left. A couple witnesses died and some have moved away. The whole thing's a damn mess and I want it straightened out. How soon would you need me? Royce shifted in his chair. Let's talk money first. Fine with me, I said. I pulled out a standard contract and passed it across the desk to him. $30 an hour, plus expenses. I'd want an advance. I bet you would, he said tartly, but the look in his eyes indicated no offense. What do I get? I don't know yet. I can't work miracles. I guess it depends on how cooperative the county sheriff's department is. I wouldn't count on them. Sheriff's department doesn't like Bailey. They never liked him much, and his escape didn't warm any hearts, made all those people look like idiots. Where's he being held? L.A. County Jail. He's being moved up to San Luis tomorrow, is what we heard. Have you talked to him? Just briefly yesterday. Must have been a shock. I thought I was hearing things. Thought I'd had a stroke. Ann spoke up.
Bailey always told Pop he was innocent.
Well, he is, Royce snapped. I said that from the first. He never would have killed Jean under any circumstance.
I'm not arguing, Pop. I'm just telling her.
Royce didn't bother to apologize, but his tone underwent a change. I don't have long, he went on. I want this squared away before I go. You find out who killed her, and I'll see there's a bonus. That's not necessary, I said. You'll get a written report once a week, and we can talk as often as you like. All right, then. I own a motel up in Floral Beach. You can stay free of charge for as long as you need. Take your meals with us, and here cooks. She flashed a look at him.
She might not want to take her meals with us.
Let her say so, if that's the case. Nobody's forcing her to do anything. She colored up at that, but said nothing more. Nice family, I thought. I couldn't wait to meet the rest. Ordinarily, I don't take on clients sight unseen, but I was intrigued by the situation, and I needed the work. Not for the money, so much as my mental health. What's the timetable here? You can drive up tomorrow. The attorney's in San Luis. He'll tell you what he wants. I filled out the contract and watched Royce Fowler sign. I added my signature, gave him one copy, and kept the other for my files. The check he took from his wallet was already made out to me in the amount of $2,000. The man had confidence. I had to give him that. I glanced at the clock as the two of them left. The entire transaction hadn't taken more than 20 minutes. I closed the office early and dropped my car off at the mechanics for a tune-up. I drive a 15-year-old VW, one of those homely beige models with assorted dents. It rattles, and it's rusty, but it's paid for, it runs fine, and it's cheap on gas. I walked home from the garage through a perfect February afternoon, sunny and clear, with the temperature hovering in the 60s. Winter storms had been blowing through at intervals since Christmas, and the mountains were dark green, the fire danger laid to rest until summer rolled around again. I live near the beach on a narrow side street that parallels Cabana Boulevard. My garage apartment, flattened by a bomb during the Christmas holidays, had now been reframed, though Henry was being coy about the plans he'd drawn up. He and the contractor had had their heads bent together for weeks, but so far he'd declined to let me see the blueprints. I don't spend a lot of time at home, so I didn't much care what the place looked like. My real worry was that Henry would make it too large or too opulent, and I'd feel obliged to pay him accordingly. My current rent is only $200 a month, unheard of these days. With my car paid for and my office space underwritten by California Fidelity, I can live very well on a modest monthly sum. I don't want an apartment too fancy for my pocketbook. Still, the property is his, and he can do with it as he pleases. Altogether, I thought it best to mind my own business and let him do what suited him. Chapter 2. I let myself in through the gate and circled the new construction to Henry's patio in the rear. He was standing near the back fence, chatting with our next-door neighbor while he hosed down the flagstones. He didn't miss a beat, but his gaze flicked over to the side of me, and a slight smile crossed his face. I never think of him as elderly, though he'd celebrated his 82nd birthday on Valentine's Day the week before. He's tall and lean, with a narrow face and blue eyes the color of gas jets. He's got a shock of soft white hair that he wears brushed to one side. Good teeth, all his, a year-round tan. His overriding intelligence is tempered with warmth, and his curiosity hasn't diminished a whit with age. Until his retirement, he worked as a commercial baker. He still can't resist making breads and sweet rolls, cookies and cakes, which he trades to merchants in the area for goods and services. His current passion is designing crossword puzzles for those little paperback publications you can pick up in a supermarket checkout line. He also clips coupons, priding himself on all the money he saves. At Thanksgiving, for instance, he managed to buy a 23-pound turkey for only $7. Then, of course, he had to invite 15 people in to help him polish it off. If I had to find fault with him, I suppose I'd have to cite his gullibility and a tendency to be passive when he ought to take a stand and fight. In some ways, I see myself as his protector, a notion that might amuse him, as he probably sees himself as mine. I still wasn't used to living under the same roof with him. My stay was temporary, just until my apartment was finished, perhaps another month. Peripheral damage to his place had been speedily repaired, except for the sun porch, which was demolished along with the garage. I had my own key to the house, and I came and went as I pleased, but there were times when the emotional claustrophobia got to me. I like Henry. A lot. There couldn't be anyone better natured than he. But I've been on my own for 8 years plus, and I'm not used to having anyone at such close range. It was making me edgy, as if he might have some expectation of me that I could never meet. Perversely, I found myself feeling guilty for my own uneasiness. When I let myself in the back door, I could smell something cooking. Onions, garlic, tomatoes, probably a chicken dish. A dome of freshly baked bread was resting on a metal rack. The kitchen table was set for two. Henry'd had a girlfriend briefly who'd redecorated his kitchen. At the time, she'd been hoping to rearrange his life savings, $20,000 in cash, which she thought might look better in her own bank account. She was thwarted, thanks to me, and all that remained of her at this point were the kitchen curtains, green print cotton tied back with green bows. Henry was currently using the color-coordinated table napkins for handkerchiefs. We never spoke of Lila, but I sometimes wondered if he didn't secretly resent my intrusion into his romance. Sometimes being fooled by love is worth the price. At least you know you're alive and capable of feeling, even if all you end up with is chest pain. I moved through the hallway to the small back bedroom I was currently calling home. Just walking in the door had made me feel restless, and I thought ahead to the trip to Floral Beach with relief. Outside, I heard the squawk of the faucet being turned off, and I could picture Henry neatly recoiling the hose. The screen door banged, and in a moment I heard the creak of his rocker, the rustle of the newspaper as he folded it over to the sports section, which he always read first. There was a small pile of clean clothes at the foot of the bed. I crossed to the chest of drawers and stared at myself in the mirror. I looked cranky, no doubt about it. My hair is dark, and I cut it myself with a pair of nail scissors every 6 weeks. The effect is just about what you'd expect. Ragged, inexpert. Recently someone told me it looked like a dog's rear end. I ran my hands through my mop, but it didn't do much good. My brow was furrowed in a little knot of discontent, which I smoothed with one finger. Hazel eyes, dark lashes. My nose blows real good, and it's remarkably straight considering it's been broken twice. Like a chimp, I bared my teeth, satisfied to see them, more or less, lined upright. I don't wear makeup. I'd probably look better if I did something with my eyes. Mascara, eyebrow pencil, eyeshadow in two shades. But then I'd be forever fooling around with this stuff, which seems like a waste of time. I was raised for the most part by a maiden aunt, whose notion of beauty care was an occasional swipe of cold cream underneath her eyes. I was never taught to be girlish. So here I am at 32, stuck with a face unadorned by cosmetic subterfuge. As it is, we could not call mine a beautiful puss, but it does the job well enough, distinguishing the front of my head from the back. Which was neither here nor there, as my appearance was not the source of my disquiet. So what was my problem? I went back to the kitchen and paused in the doorway. Henry had poured himself a drink, as he does every night, blackjack on the rocks. He glanced at me idly and then did a proper double-take, fixing me with a look.
What's wrong?
I got a job today up in Floral Beach. I'll probably be gone a week to 10 days.
Oh, is that all? That's good. You need a change.
He turned back to the paper, leafing through the section on local news. I stood there and stared at the back of his head. A painting by Whistler came immediately to mind. In a flash, I understood what was going on. Henry, are you mothering me?
What makes you say that?
Being here feels weird.
In what way?
I don't know. Dinner on the table, stuff like that.
I like to eat. Sometimes I eat 2-3 times a day, he said placidly.
He found the crossword puzzle at the bottom of the funnies and reached for a ballpoint pen. He wasn't giving this nearly the attention it deserved. You swore you wouldn't fuss over me if I moved in.
I don't fuss.
You do fuss.
You're the one fussing. I haven't said a word.
What about the laundry? You've got clothes folded up at the foot of my bed.
Throw 'em on the floor if you don't like 'em there.
Come on, Henry, that's not the point. I said I'd do my own laundry, and you agreed.
Henry shrugged. Hey, so I'm a liar. What can I say?
Would you quit? I don't need a mother.
You need a keeper. I've said so for months. You don't have a clue how to take care of yourself. You eat junk, get beat up, place gets blown to bits. I told you to get a dog, but you refuse. So now you got me. And if you ask me, it serves you right.
How irksome. I felt like one of those ducklings inexplicably bonded to a mother cat. My parents had been killed in a car wreck when I was 5. In the absence of real family, I'd simply done without. Now, apparently, old dependencies had surfaced. I knew what that meant. This man was 82. Who knew how long he'd live? Just about the time I let myself get attached to him, he'd drop dead. Ha ha, the joke's on you again. I don't want a parent. I want you as a friend.
I am a friend.
Well, then cut the nonsense. It's making me nuts. Henry's smile was benign as he checked his watch.
You've got time for a run before dinner if you quit mouthing off.
That stopped me. I'd really hoped to get a run in before dark. It was almost 4:30, and a glance at the kitchen window showed I didn't have long. I abandoned my complaints and changed into jogging sweats. The beach that day was odd. The passing storm clouds had stained the horizon a sepia shade. The mountains were a drab brown, the sky a poisonous-looking tincture of iodine. Maybe Los Angeles was burning to the ground, sending up this mirage of copper-colored smoke turning umber at the edge. I ran along the bike path that borders the sand. The Santa Teresa coastline actually runs east and west. On a map, it looks like the ragged terrain takes a sudden left turn, heading briefly out to sea before the currents force it back. The islands were visible, hovering offshore, the channel dotted with oil rigs that sparkled with light. It's worrisome but true that the oil rigs have taken on an eerie beauty of their own, as natural to the eye now as orbiting satellites. By the time I made the turnaround a mile and a half down the path, twilight had descended and the streetlights were ablaze. It was getting cold, and the air smelled of salt, the surf battering the beach. There were boats anchored beyond the breakers, the poor man's yacht harbor. The traffic was a comfort, illuminating the grassy strip between the sidewalk and the bike path. I try to run every day, not from passion, but because it saved my life more than once. In addition to the jogging, I usually lift weights 3 times a week. But I'd had to discontinue that temporarily, due to injuries. By the time I got home, I was in a better mood. There's no way to sustain anxiety or depression when you're out of breath. Something in the sweat seems to bring cheer in its wake. We ate supper, chatting companionably, and then I went to my room and packed a bag for the trip. I hadn't begun to think about the situation up in Floral Beach, but I took a minute to open a file folder, which I labeled with Bailey Fowler's name. I sorted through the newspapers, stacked up in the utility room, clipping the section that detailed his arrest. According to the article, he'd been out on parole on an armed robbery conviction at the time his 17-year-old ex-sweetheart was found strangled to death. Residents of the resort town reported that Fowler, then 23, had been involved in drugs off and on for years. and speculated that he'd killed the girl when he learned of her romantic entanglement with a friend of his. With the plea bargain, he'd been sentenced to 6 years in the state prison. He'd served less than a year at the men's colony at San Luis Obispo when he engineered his escape. He left California, assuming the alias of Peter Lambert. After a number of miscellaneous sales jobs, he'd gone to work for a clothing manufacturer with outlets in Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, and California. In 1979, the company had promoted him to Western Division Manager. He was transferred to Los Angeles, where he'd been residing ever since. The newspaper indicated that his colleagues were stunned to learn he'd ever been in trouble. They described him as hard-working, competent, outgoing, articulate, active in church and community affairs. The black-and-white photograph of Bailey Fowler showed a man maybe 40 years old, half-turned toward the camera, his face blank with disbelief. His features were strong, a refined version of his father's, with the same pugnacious jawline. An inset showed the police photograph taken of him 17 years before, when he was booked for the murder of Jean Timberlake. Since then, his hairline had receded slightly, and there was a suggestion that he may have darkened the color. But then again, that might have been a function of age or the quality of the photograph. He'd been a handsome kid, and he wasn't bad-looking now. Curious, I thought, that a man can reinvent himself. There was something enormously appealing in the idea of setting one persona aside and constructing a second to take its place. I wondered if serving out his sentence in prison would have had as laudatory an effect as being out in the world, getting on with his life. There was no mention of a family, so I had to guess he'd never married. Unless this new attorney of his was a legal wizard, he'd have to serve the remaining years of his original sentence, plus an additional 16 months to 2 years on the felony escape charge. He could be 47 by the time he was released, years he probably wasn't interested in giving up without a fight. The current paper had a follow-up article, which I also clipped. For the most part, it was a repetition of the first, except that a high school yearbook photo of the murdered girl was included along with his. She'd been a senior. Her dark hair was glossy and straight, cut to the shape of her face, parted in the middle, and curving in softly at the nape of her neck. Her eyes were pale, lined with black, her mouth wide and sensual. There was the barest suggestion of a smile, and it gave her an air of knowing something the rest of us might not be aware of yet. I slipped the clippings in the folder, which I tucked into the outside pocket of my canvas duffel. I'd stop by the office and pick up my portable typewriter en route. At 9 the next morning, I was on the road, heading up the pass that cuts through the San Rafael Mountains. As the two-lane highway crested, I glanced to my right, struck by the sweep of undulating hills that move northward, intersected by bare bluffs. The rugged terrain is tinted to a hazy blue-gray by the nature of the underlying rock. The land here has lifted, and now the ridges of shale and sandstone project in a visible spine called the transverse ranges. Geological experts have concluded that California, west of the San Andreas Fault, has moved north up the Pacific coast by about 300 miles during the last 30 million years. The Pacific Plate is still grinding away at the continent, buckling the coastal regions in earthquake after earthquake. That we continue to go about our daily business without much thought for this process is either testimony to our fortitude or evidence of lunacy. Actually, the only quakes I've experienced have been minor tremblers that rattled dishes on the shelf or set the coat hangers in the closet to tinkling merrily. The sensation is no more alarming than being shaken awake gently by someone too polite to call your name. People in San Francisco, Coalinga, and Los Angeles will have a different tale to tell. But in Santa Teresa, aside from the big one in 1925, we've had mild, friendly earthquakes that do little more than slop some of the water out of our swimming pools. The road eased down into the valley, intersecting Highway 101 some 10 miles beyond. At 10:35, I took the Floral Beach exit, heading west toward the ocean through grassy, rolling hills dotted with oaks. I could smell the Pacific long before I laid eyes on it. Screeching seagulls heralded its appearance, but I was still surprised by the breadth of that flat line of blue. I hung a left onto the main street of Floral Beach, the ocean on my right. The motel was visible 3 blocks away, the only 3-story structure on Ocean Street. I pulled into a 15-minute parking space outside the registration office, grabbed my duffel, and went in. Chapter 3. The office was small, the registration desk blocking off access to what I surmised were the Fowler's personal quarters in the rear. My crossing the threshold had triggered a soft bell. "Be right out," someone called. It sounded like Anne. I moved to the counter and peered to my right. Through an open door, I caught a glimpse of a hospital bed. There was the murmur of voices, but I couldn't see a soul. I heard the muffled flushing of a toilet, pipes clanking noisily. The air was soon scented with the artificial bouquet of room spray, impossibly sweet. Nothing in nature has ever smelled like that. Several minutes passed. There was no seating available, so I stood where I was, turning to survey the narrow room. The carpeting was harvest gold, the walls paneled in knotty pine. A painting of autumn birches with fiery orange and yellow leaves hung above a maple coffee table on which a rack of pamphlets promoted points of interest and local businesses. I leafed through the display, picking up a brochure for the Eucalyptus Mineral Hot Springs, which I'd passed on the road coming in. The advertisement was for mud baths, hot baths, and rooms at reasonable rates, whatever that meant. "Jean Timberlake worked there in the afternoons after school," Anne said behind me. She was standing in the doorway, wearing navy slacks and a white silk shirt. She seemed more relaxed than she had in her father's company. She'd had her hair done, and it fell in loose waves to her shoulders, steering the eye away from the slightly recessed chin. I put the pamphlet back. "Doing what?" I asked. "Maid service, part-time. She worked for us, too, a couple of days a week."
"Did you know her well?"
"Well enough," she said. "She and Bailey started dating when he was 20. She was a freshman in high school." Anne's eyes were mild brown, her manner detached.
"A little young for him, wasn't she?"
Her smile was brief. 14. Any other comment was curtailed by a voice from the other room.
"Anne, is someone out there? You said you'd be right back. What's happening?"
"You'll want to meet Mother," Anne murmured in a way that generated doubts. She lifted a hinged section of the counter and I passed through.
"How's your father doing?"
"Not good. Yesterday was hard on him. He was up for a while this morning, but he's easily fatigued, and I suggested he go back to bed."
"You've really got your hands full."
She flashed me a pained smile. "I've had to take a leave of absence."
"What sort of work?"
"I'm a guidance counselor at the high school. Who knows when I'll get back." I let her lead the way into the living room, where Mrs. Fowler was now propped up in the full-sized hospital bed. She was gray-haired and heavy, her dark eyes magnified by thick glasses in heavy plastic frames. She was wearing a white cotton hospital gown that tied down the back. The neck was plain, with San Luis Obispo County Hospital inked in block letters along the rim. It struck me as curious that she'd affect such garb when she could have worn a bed jacket or a gown and robe of her own. Illness as theater, perhaps. Her legs lay on top of the bedclothes, like haunches of meat not yet trimmed of fat. Her pudgy feet were bare, and her toes were mottled gray. I crossed to the bed, holding my hand toward hers.
"Hi, how are you? I'm Kinsey Milhone," I said.
We shook hands, if that's what you'd call it. Her fingers were as cold and rubbery as cooked rigatoni.
"Your husband mentioned you weren't feeling well," I went on.
She put her handkerchief to her mouth and promptly burst into tears.
"Oh, Kenny, I'm so sorry. I can't help myself. I'm just all turned around with Bailey showing up. We thought he was dead, and here he comes again. I've been sick for years, but this has just made it worse."
"I can understand your distress."
"It's Kinsey," I said.
"It's what?"
"My first name is Kinsey, my mother's maiden name. I thought you said Kenny, and I wasn't sure you heard it right."
"Oh, Lord, I'm so sorry. My hearing's nearly gone, and I can't brag about my eyes. Anne, honey, fetch a chair."
I can't think where your manners went. She reached for a Kleenex and honked into it.
"This is fine," I said. "I've just driven up from Santa Teresa, so it feels good to be on my feet."
"Kinsey's the investigator Pop hired yesterday."
"I know that," Mrs. Fowler said.
She began to fuss with her cotton cover, plucking it this way and that, made restless by topics that didn't pertain to her.
"I hope to get myself all cleaned up, but Anne said she had errands. I hate to interfere with her any more than I have to, but there's just things I can't do with my arthritis so bad.
Now look at me. I'm a mess. I'm Ori, short for Oribel. You must think I'm a sight.
Not at all. You look fine. I tell lies all the time. One more couldn't hurt.
I'm a diabetic, she said, as though I'd asked. Have been all my life, and what a toll it's took. I got tingling and numbness in my extremities, kidney problems, bad feet, and now I've developed arthritis on top of that.
She held a hand out for my inspection. I expected knuckles as swollen as prize fighters, but they looked fine to me. I'm sorry to hear that. It must be rough.
Well, I've made up my mind. I will not complain, she said. If it's anything I despise, it's people who can't accept their lot.
Anne said, Mother, you mentioned tea a little while ago. How about you, Kinsey? Will you have a cup? I'm all right for now, thanks.
None for me, hun, Ori said. My taste for it passed, but you go ahead and fix some for yourself.
I'll put the water on. Anne excused herself and left the room.
I stood there wishing I could do the same.
What I could see of the apartment looked much like the office. Gold, high-low carpeting, early American furniture, probably from Montgomery Ward. A painting of Jesus hung on the wall at the foot of the bed. He had his palms open, eyes lifted toward heaven, pained, no doubt, by Ori's home decorating taste. She caught my eye.
Bailey gave me that picture. It's just the kind of boy he was.
It's very nice, I replied, then quizzed her while I could. How'd he get mixed up in a murder charge?
Well, it wasn't his fault. He fell in with bad company. He didn't do good in high school, and after he got out, he couldn't find him a job. And then he ran into Tap Granger. I detested that no account the minute I laid eyes on him. The two of 'em running around till all hours, getting into trouble. Royce was having fits.
Bailey was dating Jean Timberlake by then.
I guess that's right, she said, apparently hazy on the details after so much time had passed. She was a sweet girl, despite what everybody said about that mother of hers.
The telephone rang, and she reached over to the bed table to pick it up.
Motel, she said.
Uh-huh, that's right.
This month or next? Just a minute, I'll check.
She pulled the reservation book closer, removing a pencil from between the pages. I watched her flip forward into March, peering closely at the print. Her tone, as she conducted business, was completely matter-of-fact. Gone was the suggestion of infirmity that marked her ordinary speech. She licked the pencil point and made a note, discussing king-sized beds versus queen. I took the opportunity to go in search of Anne. A doorway on the far wall led out into a hallway, with rooms opening off the central corridor in either direction. On the right there was a staircase leading to the floor above. I could hear water being run, and then the faint tap of the tea kettle on the burner in the kitchen to my left. It was hard to get a fix on the overall floor plan, and I had to guess the apartment had been patched together from a number of motel rooms with the intervening walls punched out. The resulting townhouse was spacious but jerry-built, with the traffic patterns of a maze. I peeked into the room across the hall. Dining room with a bath attached. There was access to the kitchen through what must have been an alcove for hanging clothes. I paused in the doorway. Anne was setting cups and saucers on an industrial-sized aluminum serving tray.
Need any help?
She shook her head.
Look around if you like. Daddy built the place himself when he and Mother first got married.
Nice, I said.
Well, it's not any more, but it was perfect for them. Has she given you a key yet? You might want to take your bags up. I think she's putting you in room 22 upstairs. It's got an ocean view and a little kitchenette.
Thanks. That's great. I'll take my bags up in a bit. I'm hoping to talk to the attorney this afternoon.
I think Pop set up an appointment for you at 1:45. He'll probably want to tag along if he's feeling up to it. He tends to want to stage manage. I hope that's all right.
Actually, it's not. I'll want to go alone. Your parents seem defensive about Bailey, and I don't want to have to cope with that when I'm trying to get a rundown on the case.
Yes, all right. I can see your point. I'll see if I can talk Pop out of it.
Water began to rumble in the bottom of the kettle. She took tea bags from a red and white tin canister on the counter. The kitchen itself was old-fashioned. The linoleum was a pale gridwork of squares in beige and green, like an aerial view of hay and alfalfa fields. The gas stove was white, with chrome trim, unused burners concealed by jointed panels that folded back. The sink was shallow, of white porcelain, supported by two stubby legs. The refrigerator small, round-shouldered, and yellowing with age, probably with a freezer compartment the size of a bread box. The tea kettle began to whistle. Anne turned the burner off and poured boiling water in a white teapot.
"What do you take?"
"Plain is fine." I followed her back into the living room where Ori was struggling to get out of bed. She'd already swung her feet over the side, her gown hitching up to expose the crinkled white of her thighs.
"Mother, what are you doing?"
"I have to go sit on the pot again, and you were taking so long I didn't think I could wait."
"Why didn't you call? You know you're not supposed to get up without help. Honestly."
Anne set the tray down on a wooden serving cart and moved over to the bed to give her mother a hand. Ori descended ponderously, her wide knees trembling visibly as they took her weight. The two proceeded awkwardly into the other room.
"Why don't I go ahead and get my things out of the car?" "Do that," she called. "We won't be long."
The breeze off the ocean was chilly, but the sun was out.
I shaded my eyes for a moment, peering at the town, where pedestrian traffic was picking up as the noon hour approached. Two young mothers crossed the street at a languid pace, pushing strollers, while a dog pranced along behind them with a frisbee in his mouth. This was not the tourist season, and the beach was sparsely populated. Empty playground equipment was rooted in the sand. The only sounds were the constant shushing of the surf and the high, thin whine of a small plane overhead.
I retrieved my duffel and the typewriter, bumping my way back into the office. By the time I reached the living room, Anne was helping Ori into bed again. I paused, waiting for them to notice me.
"I need my lunch," Ori was saying querulously to Anne.
"Fine, Mother. Let's go ahead and do a test. We should have done it hours ago anyway."
"I don't want to fool with it. I don't feel that good."
I could see Anne curbing her temper at the tone her mother used. She closed her eyes.
"You're under a lot of stress," she said evenly. "Dr. Ortega wants you to be very careful till he sees you next."
"He didn't tell me that."
"That's because you didn't talk to him."
"Well, I don't like Mexicans."
"He's not Mexican, he's Spanish."
"I still can't understand a word he says. Why can't I have a real doctor who speaks English?"
"I'll be right with you, Kinsey," Anne murmured, catching sight of me. "Let me just get Mother settled first."
"I can take my bags up if you tell me where they go." There was a brief territorial dispute as the two of them argued about which room to put me in. In the meantime, Anne was taking out cotton balls, alcohol, and some sort of testing strip sealed in a paper packet. I looked on with discomfort, an unwilling witness as she swabbed her mother's fingertip and pierced it with a lancet. I could feel myself going nearly cross-eyed with distaste. I moved over to the bookcase, feigning interest in the titles on the shelves. Lots of inspirational reading and condensed versions of Leon Uris books. I pulled out a volume at random and leafed through, blocking out the scene behind me. I waited a decent interval, tucked the book away, and then turned back casually. Anne had apparently read the test results from the digital display on a meter by the bed and was filling a syringe from a small vial of pale, milky liquid I presumed was insulin. I busied myself with a glass paperweight. A nativity scene in a swirling cloud of snow. Baby Jesus was no bigger than a paperclip. God, I'm a sissy when it comes to shots. From the rustling sounds behind me, I surmised they were done. Anne broke the needle off the disposable syringe and tossed it in the trash. She tidied up the bed table, and then we moved out to the desk so she could give me my room key. Ori was already calling out a request. Chapter 4. By 1:30 I had driven the 12 miles to San Luis Obispo, and I was circling through the downtown area, trying to orient myself and get a feel for the place. The commercial buildings are 2 to 4 stories high and immaculately maintained. This is clearly a museum town, with Spanish and Victorian structures restored and adapted to current use. The storefronts are painted in handsome dark shades, many with awnings arching over the windows. The establishment seemed to be divided just about equally between trendy clothing stores and trendy restaurants. Carrotwood trees border most avenues, with strings of tiny Italian lights woven into branches bursting with green. Any businesses not catering directly to the tourists seem geared to the tastes of the Cal Poly students, in evidence everywhere. Bailey Fowler's new attorney was a man named Jack Clemson, with an address on Mill, a block from the courthouse. I pulled into a parking space and locked my car. The office was located in a small, brown frame cottage with a pointed gable in the roof and a narrow wooden porch enclosed by trellises. A white picket fence surrounded the property, with a tangle of geraniums crowding in among the pales. Judging from the lettered sign affixed to the gate, Jack Clemson was the sole tenant. I climbed the wooden porch steps and moved into the entrance hall, now furnished as a reception area. A grandfather clock on the wall to my left gave the only sense of life, the brass pendulum snick-snacking back and forth mechanically. The former parlor on the right was lined with old-fashioned, glass-fronted oak bookcases. There was an oak desk with a typing L, a swivel chair, a Xerox machine, but no secretary in sight. The screen on the computer monitor was blank, the surface of the desk neatly stacked with legal briefs and brown accordion files tied with string. Across the hall, the door to the matching parlor was shut. One of the buttons on the telephone was lighted, and I could smell fresh cigarette smoke drifting out from somewhere in the back. Otherwise, the office seemed deserted. I took a seat in an old church pew with a slot for hymnals underneath the bench. It was filled now with alumni journals from Columbia University Law School, which I leafed through idly. Presently, I heard footsteps, and Clemson appeared.
"Miss Milhone, Jack Clemson, nice to meet you. You'll have to pardon the reception. My secretary's out sick, and the temp's still off at lunch. Come on back."
We shook hands, and I followed him. He was maybe 55 and heavyset, one of those men who'd probably been considered portly since birth. He was short and squat, wide-shouldered and balding. His features were babyfied, sparse eyebrows and a soft, undefined nose with red dents along the bridge. A pair of tortoiseshell reading glasses were shoved up on his head, and strands of hair were standing straight up on end. His shirt collar was unbuttoned, and his tie was loose. Apparently he hadn't had time to shave, and he scratched at his chin experimentally as if to gauge the morning's growth. His suit was tobacco brown, impeccably tailored, but wrinkled across the seat. His office occupied the entire rear half of the building, and had French doors that opened out onto a sunny deck. Both of the dark green leather chairs intended for clients were piled high with legal briefs. Clemson scooped up an armload of books and files and set them on the floor, motioning for me to take a seat while he went around to the far side of the desk. He caught a glimpse of himself in the mirror hanging on the wall to his left, and his hand returned involuntarily to the stubble on his chin. He sat down and pulled a portable electric razor from his desk drawer. He flicked it on and began to slide it around his face with a practiced hand, mowing a clean path across his upper lip. The shaver buzzed like a distant airplane.
"I've got a court date in 30 minutes. Sorry I can't spare you any more time this afternoon."
"That's all right," I said. "When does Bailey get in?"
"He's probably here by now. Deputy drove down this morning to bring him back. I made arrangements for you to see him at 3:15. It's not regular visiting hours, but Quintana said it's okay. It's his case. He was rookie of the year back then."
"What about the arraignment?"
8:30 tomorrow morning. If you're interested, you can come here first and walk over with me. That'll give us a chance to compare notes."
"I'd like that." Clemson made a note on his desk calendar.
"Will you be going back over to the Ocean Street this afternoon?"
"Sure." He tucked the electric shaver away and closed the desk drawer. He reached for some papers, which he folded and slipped into an envelope, scrawling Royce's name across the front.
"Tell Royce this is ready for his signature," he said.
I tucked the envelope in my handbag.
"How much of the background on this have you been told?"
"Not much." He lit a cigarette, coughing into his fist. He shook his head, apparently annoyed by the state of his lungs.
"I had a long talk this morning with Clifford Leto, the PD who handled Fowler's case. He's retired now. Nice man. Bought a vineyard about 60 miles north of here. Says he's growing Chardonnay and Pinot Noir grapes. I wouldn't mind doing that myself one of these days. Anyway, he went through his old files for me and pulled the case notes."
"What's the story on that? Why'd the DA make a deal?" Clemson gestured dismissively.
It was all circumstantial evidence. George DeWitt was the district attorney. You ever run into him?
Probably not.
It would have been way before your time. He's a superior court judge now. I avoid him like the plague.
I've heard of him. He's got political aspirations, doesn't he?
For all the good it's going to do. He's into the sauce, and it's the kiss of death. You never know which way he's going to go on a case. He's not unfair, but he's inconsistent. Which is too bad. George was a hot dogger, very flashy guy. He hated to bargain a high-publicity case, but he wasn't a fool. From what I hear, the Timberlake murder looked passable on the surface, but they were short of hard evidence. Fowler was known around town as a punk for years. His old man had thrown him out.
Wait a minute, I said. Was this before he went to jail the first time or afterward? I thought he'd been convicted of armed robbery, but nobody's given me the story on that either.
Shoot. All right, let me back up a bit. This was 2-3 years before. I got the dates here somewhere, but it matters not. The deal is Fowler and a fellow named Tap Granger hooked up right around the time Fowler got out of high school. Bailey was a good-looking kid, and he was smart enough, but he never got it together. You probably know the type. He was just one of those kids who seems destined to go sour. From what Leto says, Bailey and Tap were doing a lot of drugs. They had to pay the local dope peddler, so they started bumping off gas stations. Nickel and dime jobs, and they're rank amateurs. Idiots. They're wearing pantyhose on their heads, trying to act like big-time hoods. Of course, they got caught. Rupert Russell was the PD on that one, and he did the best he could.
Why not a private attorney? Was Bailey indigent?
In essence, he didn't have the dough himself, and his old man refused to pop for any legal fees.
Clemson took a drag of his cigarette. Had Bailey been in trouble as a juvenile?
Nope, his record was clean. He probably figured all he'd get was a slap on the wrist. This is armed robbery, you understand. But Tap carried the gun, so I guess Bailey thought somehow that let him off the hook. Unfortunately for him, the statute doesn't read that way. Anyway, when they offered him a deal, he turned him down cold, pleaded not guilty, and went to trial instead. Needless to say, the jury convicted, and the judge got tough. Back then, robbery was 1 to 10 in the state prison.
That was still indeterminate sentencing?
Yeah, that's right. Back then they had a Bureau of Prison